Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for being here. I'm honored to be here presenting my work among my fellow panelists, and I think they really set the stage, and hopefully I'll be able to contribute with some concrete evidence from a population that we actually don't hear a lot about. And I think one of the reasons why is most people don't think that toddlers are drinking soda, and it's also not a surveillance mechanism that's also done. So as evidenced by my title, I'm going to be talking about risk factors of soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages among a two-year-old sample from Oregon. And I'd like to acknowledge the two other authors on this paper, Ken Rosenberg and Dan Morris. I don't think they're in the audience right now. Before I get started, I just want to give a little bit of project background to sort of contextualize this within my own work. So as Beth mentioned, I'm currently a doctoral student at the Harvard School of Public Health. And in the summer of 2009, I received a fellowship with the Maternal Child Health Information Resource Center. It's a mouthful. And they have a graduate student internship program. And I was placed at the Oregon Department of Human Services. And so it was a joint collaboration between the Harvard School of Public Health, the Oregon Department of Human Services Office of Family Health. And I also would like to acknowledge Alfredo Sandoval and the great people in Oregon who helped me think about this project. If anyone's here from Oregon, I love the state. So the major research question for this project was, what are the risk factors for sugar-sweetened beverages among 24-month-olds? And given that there's a dearth of evidence about both the prevalence and distribution of soda and other sugar-sweetened beverages among this population, this was much more of an exploratory study trying to confirm if we're seeing similar trends among this population as we see in older children. And clearly, SSBs are a very timely topic in public health. They've been a prominent feature at this conference, and I was very excited and honored to go hear from some national experts yesterday about the tax and also for advertising for kids. And I think, I don't know if anyone was at the advertising talk yesterday, but the sippy cups that have the Coke and Pepsi labels on the sippy cups, that picture always astonishes me, that children are given sippy cups with the marketing right there on them. So just a note to clarify some for some definitional purposes, consistent with other studies in the literature, we define sugar-sweetened beverages as soda and other sweetened fruit drinks, which include Kool-Aid and those sorts of things. So just some background, how much are our kids drinking from some national estimates? So for adolescents ages 11 to 18, they're currently consuming 300 calories a day, which is 13% of their total caloric intake. For children 6 to 11, they're consuming less, 184, which is 9% of their total caloric intake. And these numbers always astonish me. So this is among preschoolers, 2 to 5. They're consuming 124 calories per day, and that's 7% of their total caloric intake as well. And then really focusing on early initiation of sugar-sweetened beverages, there's really not that much other literature out there among 0 to 2-year-olds, but I'm borrowing from some other literature from 2 to 5. And Gail has already mentioned this fact too, that 10% of energy intake from 2 to 3-year-olds are attributed to SSBs, and that's doubled since 1994, which is not too long ago. And so, if you think about it in terms of per ounce, 2 to 5-year-olds are consuming a 15-ounce SSB on a typical day, which is one of those larger Pepsi bottles or Coke bottles. And using some NHANES data, researchers found that 39% of preschoolers drink soda. So the health effects of SSB consumption, and we heard this from Gail very nicely, that there's sort of unequivocal evidence that SSB consumption is causally linked to obesity and diabetes. And the several studies, I think Andy was alluding to this, that have not found a statistical association between SSB and overweight were funded by the beverage industry. So I don't think we can actually debate this point anymore. But in addition to obesity and diabetes, there's obviously increased overall caloric intake from SSBs, but we don't talk about oral health that much, but there's been a lot of studies showing, especially among youth, that there's increased dental caries with the added SSB consumption. And also, there's greater bone loss because of a displacement of calcium in milk. And also, using sort of a life course conceptual framework, we also know that the patterning of food tracks over time, So children as young as 2 develop their taste preferences. So if children as young as 2 are drinking soda and lots of sugary food, that's likely going to transition across the life course. And we also know that overweight transitions across the life course. So that's probably going to be something that goes in tandem across the life course. And one thing I have also been interested in is we don't really read about the caffeine effects. So if 2-year-olds are drinking all of this soda and there's so much caffeine, what is that doing to sleep patterns? And we also know that decreased sleep is tied to obesity. So there might be other mechanisms here related to caffeine that is still not yet to be discovered. So some of the methods. So I used 3 linked data sets, which was very cool actually. So we used the Oregon State issued birth certificates from both 2004 and 2005. And I don't know if anyone in this room is familiar with the PRAM survey, but it's the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring Survey. And it's a CDC-funded surveillance program implemented by different state health departments. And I believe 33 states right now have a PRAM survey. And PRAMS interviews moms 2 months postpartum. And Oregon actually is one of 3 states that does a follow-back survey for PRAMS respondents. So when the child is 24 months old, the mother is re-interviewed, provided that she didn't write on the first one, "I don't want to be contacted again." And so we were able to get a longitudinal, and that's how we got the two-year-old data. So we have the mothers when they were right after the hospital when they had a birth, and then 2 years later. And here's the link to the Oregon Health Department if you want more information about this survey. And the other 2 states are Alaska and Oklahoma that do this sort of follow-back. So the response rate for the PRAMS 2 for the years 2006-2007 was 56.7%, which is pretty substantial. And this was weighted back to the original PRAMS respondents, both people who responded and didn't respond. So it really is a population-based sample, not just. So we're trying to avoid selection bias and all of our epi things we have to worry about. So the description of the sample, so this is in Oregon again. So there was 1,911 mothers who responded to the PRAMS 2 in those 2 years. And 126 mothers I excluded from the final analysis because they didn't answer the soda and fruit drink question. So a total of 1,785. And so Oregon is the mothers in the sample were majority white, 70%. Majority had greater than 12th grade education. 76% lived in an urban county at the time of their birth of the child. And 37% of mothers were overweight or obese during PRAMS 2, so when the child was 24 months old. So I wanted to show where the variables were coming from, so to anchor this in time. So consistent with the American Academy of Pediatrics, who recommends no consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages for children before the age of 2, our outcome variable was no SSB consumption versus 1 or more a day. And so from the birth certificate, we have maternal race ethnicity, maternal age at birth, and county type. And from the PRAMS, which so this samples moms when they just gave birth, we have maternal height and weight, and we also have exclusive breastfeeding at 10 weeks. And then from PRAMS 2, I have highest education attained for the mom, eating out, child screen time, household income, and then that's the SSB consumption. So here's a graph showing the distribution of sugar-sweetened beverages among the toddlers. And I partitioned the SSBs into soda and fruit drinks, so you can see how that is driving the SSB consumption. And it's to note that almost half of the mothers report that their children are drinking SSBs at least one day a week. And you can see that mothers were more likely to report that they were drinking fruit drink and Kool-Aid more likely than soda. But I also don't want to forget about this bar here, the zero bar, because we also in public health don't recognize things that people are doing well. So, you know, almost half of mothers are reporting that the children aren't drinking sugar-sweetened beverages as well. So that's good. And then this slide shows the distribution by racial and ethnic groups. And so what's interesting, so Oregon actually has a pretty substantial Hispanic population. And so the second layer of color-coded bars is our Hispanic moms. And 75% of them reported that their children were drinking SSBs on 1 or more days per week. And here I think it's also very interesting to see the breakout of fruit drink and Kool-Aid and soda within each racial and ethnic group. So as you notice, within the Hispanic maternal racial and ethnic group, the kids are drinking soda and fruit drink Kool-Aid at pretty much a similar rate. And that's actually not true among the other racial and ethnic groups represented. So among the American Indian, Alaskan Native, among the African American mothers, and among the Asian Pacific Islanders, they're reporting that their children are drinking more fruit drink and Kool-Aid than soda. So we often, in the sugar sweetened beverage literature, don't talk about the difference between what makes up an SSB, and I think this calls for maybe some targeted education and also targeted policy as well. So here's the analytic approach that we used. We first did univariate associations and descriptive statistics just to see the associated risk factors with sugar-sweetened beverages. And then I ran three separate models because I really wanted to see, after controlling for our, you know, prominent demographic variables, if there was different risk factors for soda, fruit drink and Kool-Aid, and also SSBs together. So these are the three models that I modeled, and I'm actually only going to present the model for sugar-sweetened beverages because my supervisor decided that that slide was really messy with all of the three in it. So I tried to take an innovative approach to showing odds ratios and 95% confidence intervals using the new Microsoft PowerPoint. So here are the results from our multivariate model, and these are the significant risk factors for sugar-sweetened beverages, and they're ordered in relative magnitude. So after controlling for household income, county residence, child screen time, breastfeeding, maternal pre-pregnancy BMI, household income is the greatest predictor of sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. But as you can also see, even after controlling for all of our demographic variables, maternal Hispanic ethnicity was also a significant risk factor. And the association with the other racial and ethnic groups was actually attenuated. So this was the only racial and ethnic group that was still significant after controlling for everything else. And consistent with other literature, child screen time and eating out were also two very strong predictors of sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. And also maternal pre-pregnancy BMI was also very significant as well. And there's been some other research showing that, but I'm not sure if this mechanism is through an intrauterine pathway or through a maternal modeling. If the mom's drinking soda, maybe the child is more likely to drink soda as well, but I'd be interested to see if we could find a mechanism for why maternal pre-pregnancy BMI is significant. So some of the strengths and limitations of this study. So this is a huge gap in the literature. We really don't know how much young toddlers are drinking, and I think this could really propel the conversation about the sugar-sweetened tax incentives if we talk more about especially our younger children. And also we use data from multiple time points, so we're able to have a little bit of longitudinal in our design. And this was also a population-based sample, so that increases our generalizability. So we really can extrapolate the results of this to the larger population of Oregon, unfortunately not to the rest of the country. And the data is both on soda and fruit drinks, so I think that's pretty remarkable that you can see how the soda and fruit drink both contribute to elevated sugar-sweetened beverages differently within racial and ethnic groups. And some of the limitations, we don't know the setting of sugar-sweetened beverage consumption, and I think that's a huge limitation, actually, because some of the work by Steve Gortmaker and others have shown that actually kids and adolescents are consuming sugar-sweetened beverages at home and not actually in school. So if we don't know if these two-year-olds are drinking sugar-sweetened beverages at home or if they're drinking in a childcare setting, and this would actually really help if we wanted to do targeted outreach, so we don't know where the children are drinking it. And we also don't know the quantity. So the question asked mothers to circle, on a typical week, how often does your child drink the following liquids? So we don't know how much. But because this is a sample of two-year-olds, I don't imagine that there's a huge amount of variability because they are all sort of the same size. But I can imagine that maybe some are drinking a big gulp versus a sippy cup. I don't know. So the quantity, we don't know. And also, like any other self-reported measure, there's going to be a social desirability bias because the mother's reporting her child's dietary intake, and also there could be a recall bias. And also, we don't know what a typical week is for each family. A typical week, depending on when they got the survey, could be around the summer or holiday time when there's more sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. And also, our eating out variable really lacks specificity. So it only asks mothers to report how often do you consume foods outside of the home, and it has restaurants and supermarkets, so places that there could also be healthier meals served. So we can't tie this to fast food because it had a bunch of other different options as well. So in conclusion, household income was the most significant predictor of sugar-sweetened beverage consumption among the sample of two-year-olds. And women most likely to have two-year-olds who drink sugar-sweetened beverages greater than one day a week were low income, eat out frequently, less than 25 years at birth, of Hispanic ethnicity, reside in a rural county at time of birth, and were overweight or obese prior to their pregnancy. So for some future research, I'm actually real excited to hear from our fourth presenter about some qualitative research, because I think we really need to understand the contextual significance of drinking soda. And while I was out in Oregon, I was interviewing some pediatricians about their thoughts about this, and most of them were stunned that the kids were actually even drinking soda. And one of them who works up in Hood River, which is where a lot of the farms are in Oregon, so there's a large population of recent Mexican-American immigrants, and she was telling me that she had a woman come into her office and she had her daughter there and she was so upset because she couldn't get her two-year-old to drink soda. And the pediatrician was stunned and was like, I didn't know what to say. And the mother went on to say that Coke meant success here. Coke meant America. And so I think we also need to consider, sort of put on our medical anthropology hat and consider the contextual significance of drinking soda within specific populations and how that might be affected by a blanket sugar-sweetened beverage tax. And I also think we need to disentangle the perceived health benefits of fruit drinks versus fruit juice for toddlers, because I think I'm not even a mom and I find this very, very confusing. So I would love to try to disentangle that. And then I think we need a lot more research to understand the intersection between poverty and sugar-sweetened beverage consumption, especially among children in racial and ethnic minority populations, and sort of following off the research in obesity where we've seen sort of socioeconomic gradients in obesity and trying to understand if food insecurity is driving this or if it's disposable income going to foods that have greater satiety mechanism immediately or if it's stress driven, because this intersection is quite interesting to me and I still don't know the answer. So thank you. And I don't know if I have some time for some, yeah.
Do you know the weight participation of these children?
Yes, I do. And we actually looked at the difference of sugar and sweetened beverage consumption through the WIC, and there was no difference, so that's why we didn't include it. But that's a great question. Yeah.
Okay. And the second one is, at France, too, you had a percentage of obese moms. Did you weigh those moms, or was that a
self-report? Self-report. Yeah. But that's a great point. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can only comment that from my work here, and that was, so there was a recent study that showed the effects of an increase in sugar-sweetened beverages among low-income populations, and that they were more sensitive to the price elasticity of soda, so when it increased, they were less likely to buy it. But I do think that that's a very paternalistic approach to have the food stamps not let it, but at the same time, sugar-sweetened beverages offer absolutely no nutritional value. They're empty calories, and they're very detrimental to young kids' health. But I do think that there needs to be, in tandem, outreach and education work to populations where this might mean something more than just Coke, if that answers your question at all.